From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's the new Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, la escuela. We go back to school. Because in the new America, one in four public school students is Latino. How is that changing our educational system? Well, not too long ago, non-Latino kids wanted out of dual language classes.
But now it's transfer requests to come into our school because there's so many families that want to come from other school zones to participate in our dual language program.
Our school project? Enrolling ourselves in a year-long study of how Latinos are changing our schools. And
do you remember the little song we learned yesterday?
One little, two little, three little aliens, four little, five.
Lessons we've learned about immigration after doing this show for 20 years. All this and more coming up on our new hour-long program. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Stay with us. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and welcome to Your Latino USA. Well, I never expected to hear a 10-year-old, in the plainest of language, give this advice to kids headed to a new school in Chicago. Natrick Washington is in sixth grade.
Well, if they're really upset, like if they have a car, they could just drive to their new school because in the car it's safer, and when they're walking, they could easily get killed by somebody. But if they're in the car, they could actually just duck in their car, like in front of the seats, and they'll be safe because the most place people shoot is by the window. And if they're ducking, then they won't get hit. That's what I think they should do.
Natrick's words made my jaw drop, literally. Because for most kids, back to school is an exciting butterflies in your stomach kind of time. New teachers, new friends, new experiences. But for some Chicago students, this year, it's also a scary time. Over the summer, the Chicago School District closed more than 50 schools, fired more than 3,000 teachers and staff members, and cut classroom spending by $68 million. This forced thousands of students to cross dangerous gang territories to get to their new schools.
My name is Hector Perez. I'm in eighth grade. I'm going to Jose de Diego Elementary.
Now that the school year has started, we wanted to catch up with these kids. The changes they're undergoing are typical of what's happening in school districts around the country. Some are going bankrupt. Others are cutting to the core. Look at Philly. Look at Detroit. In Chicago, Hector was a student at Alexander von Humboldt Elementary in Humboldt Park last year. His school was closed, and he was transferred to Jose de Diego, which sixth grader Natrick Washington has attended his whole life.
Well, my reaction was like, what's going to happen? Is there going to be a lot of fights or anything? Because, like, somebody told me that some of the kids were bad, so I got worried.
Like most kids, Natrick and Hector have adapted to their situation. In fact, Hector is downright philosophical.
I understand why people are worried because although Chicago is a really nice city, there are a lot of gangs and kids, even though maybe it's not even them being in danger, but they probably look up to the gang-affiliated kids and maybe they'll want to be like them. So that's just another thing that's not good. For me, I didn't find as it was a good idea, but I like my time at Diego. I'm hoping to have the best eighth grade year that I am going to have.
The unmistakable optimism of a child going back to school. You've got to love their resiliency and their capacity for hope. This week, our hour is all about going back to school, the lessons we learn, the friends we make, and the experiences that shape who we are. In our Latino USA newsroom, we've been thinking a lot about an educational statistic that popped up earlier this year. According to the Pew Hispanic Center, one in four public school students in 2011 were Latino, which left us wondering, how is this generation shaping our educational system? And how is our educational system shaping them? By the time these students get out of college and Latino college enrollment is up, it'll be 2030. So we're starting our year-long look at this class of 2030 in Siler City, North Carolina. In case you didn't know it, Latinos have flooded into the South. And over the last decade, North Carolina's Latino population more than doubled. Back in the year 2000, those numbers made white supremacist David Duke take to the streets.
While our country and our community and our town and our schools and our heritage is taken away from us.
In one school in town, Siler City Elementary, over 60% of students are Latinos now. Yes, I said 60%. So the school decided to address the needs of English language learners by creating a dual language program, which is a classroom split between native English speakers and foreign language speakers, where they teach each other their native languages. Elizabeth Bonitz is a dual language support teacher at Siler City Elementary, who's been with the program since it began. Elizabeth Bonitz has watched the transformation of the South and the transformation of their schools. Elizabeth, as kids are now flooding into schools, school is back up and running, what's going on for you as you think about where you are right now in Siler City and where you were 20 years ago in the same region and what was happening with Latino students then?
Maria, it's so exciting this year to be in the position that I'm in, to see all the children coming back to school and knowing that we have the capabilities and the talents in our building to be able to best serve the educational needs of the children that are coming to us. 20 years ago, I got my first two ESL children in my class, and I didn't know what to do. I had not received any training at all as a teacher in preparation for what to do with a language learner in my class. And nobody in my building knew what to do, and nobody in my district knew what to do. I felt so frustrated as a teacher because I knew that I wasn't meeting the educational needs of the children that I had in my room.
As a teacher, when you saw that your students were beginning to change, and for the first time in, you know, a place like Tennessee or North Carolina, you were having Spanish language students in your classrooms, what did you do?
I went to California for a summer to get ESL certification because it was not possible to get ESL certification anywhere in Tennessee. And then I came back and I realized there's not one person, there's not one adult in my school building that speaks Spanish, and nobody can communicate with them for any reason, to tell the families that their child is sick, please can you come pick them up, or to explain a report card. And that year I decided this is unsafe. So that very next summer, I went to Mexico and enrolled in an intensive language school to try to learn as much Spanish as I could. And I learned enough that I could communicate. I'm sure it was very cryptic when I got back, but I communicated enough that I was able to make Spanish-speaking friends who helped me, and I learned more and more.
Something happened in Tennessee that made you think you had to make a different decision in terms of where you were going to stay.
The state of Tennessee passed an English-only law that said that it was illegal to teach in any other language in the state of Tennessee other than English. And when they passed that law in the spring, I said, I'm out of here. And I left that summer. I came to North Carolina.
At the time when dual language learning was happening in Siler City, did some of the Anglo families, did they decide that they needed to get away, essentially?
Well, there was not dual language education at Siler City Elementary until 2005. However, the Hispanic children had been coming into that school for about 8 to 10 years previously. And during that time, especially from 2000 to 2005, when their percentage of the student population grew, there was a lot of white flight from the school. Our school had the highest number of transfer requests, and they were granted so that they could attend other schools that did not have a large Latino population.
What's happened now?
Well, now, 8 years after we started our dual language program, we now have, once again, the highest number of transfer requests in of all the schools in our district. But now it's not transfer requests to leave our school. Now it's transfer requests to come into our school because there's so many families that want to come from other school zones to participate in our dual language program. You know, we started 8 years ago with one kindergarten class, and it was voluntary. The parents could, you know, choose if they wanted their children in a traditional class or a dual language class. And both last year and this year, none of the incoming kindergarten families requested a traditional class for their children. So we have all six of our kindergarten classes at our school last year and this year were dual language classrooms.
That is truly amazing. Did you ever imagine that that would happen?
I never imagined that would happen. I don't think anybody at our school imagined that would happen. But a way that the community has embraced it and seems to really want this for their children is really exciting. And we're thrilled to be able to provide that opportunity.
So you mentioned white flight. And as we heard earlier, in 2000, the KKK held an anti-immigrant march right in Siler City. So do you think that a dual language program in a place like Siler City can actually bring a community together in a way that otherwise they might not have?
I know the teachers and the principal at our school were like, what can we do? What can we do? Because this community, I mean, it's looking like it's going to be civil war here. You know, what are we going to be able to do to help bridge this cultural and linguistic divide? And that was, you know, that need brought the vision that those teachers and the principal had to start a dual language program at our school. And we are really excited about the future of our community because of the relationships the children have formed with one another.
Well, Elizabeth Bonitz, thank you so much for speaking to us from Siler City, North Carolina.
Thank you so much, Maria.
So what changes have you noticed in your schools as the class of 2030 grows? I bet you've got a great snippet to tell us, so send us a tweet at LatinoUSA. When we were talking about back-to-school season around the LatinoUSA newsroom, we realized we all had experiences in school when being a Latino mattered or stood out. So we reached out to some of our friends and asked them to tell us their favorite stories about being Latino in school. You'll hear a few of these throughout our program and even more on our SoundCloud. Here's our first one.
My name is Gustavo Arellano, and I'm the editor of OC Weekly and author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican.
My experience is I was always going to the Mexican schools. We were all Latinos who just happened to fill all the stereotypes of high school. So, you know, I was part of the, no, I wasn't even one of the nerds. I wasn't cool enough to be one of the nerds. But, you know, we had Latino nerds, Latino jocks, Latino stoners, Latino band geeks, Latino prom queens. For me, I think, though, the most interesting thing was that even though our high school was like 98% Latino, even we made fun of the more recent Mexican immigrants. And we used to call them Bukis y Yonics. After the grupero groups from 1980s. So we would usually get in fights with them, you know, call them dirty Mexicans or, you know, in Orange County, we have a term called WABs, W-A-B, which is, you know, basically calling them rednecks. Even though our parents were Mexican immigrants, that was just our way of asserting, I guess, our Americanness, if you will. Let me put it this way to make it nice. It used to be the whites discriminating against Mexican immigrants. Now it's the Mexicans discriminating against Mexican immigrants. That's progress, right?
Were you the bully, the jock, the straight-A student, or the rebel? Share your escuela stories with us on our Facebook page at LatinoUSA. And coming up,
this bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions.
Why Lyndon Johnson got the law right, but the impact wrong when he signed immigration reform. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Doctor!
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, back to school stories, and here's our next guest.
Irmari Reyes Santos. I live in Eugene, Oregon, and I work at the University of Oregon in the Department of Ethnic Studies. When I arrived in 2001, I got to San Diego to enter the PhD program. I was 21, and I had never lived in the U.S., in the mainland. I had lived in Puerto Rico. That's where things got a little trickier, I began to realize really early on. Because the first thing somebody told me in my program was, well, you know that nobody's ever going to let you teach in English because you have an accent. However, you know, I heard that and I said, well, I'm going to try anyway. And I got this job teaching on campus in a different program. So I get the job and then I go home for the summer. And they call me sometime in September because they need me to sign a piece of paper. And they ask me where I'm at. And I said, well, I'm in Puerto Rico with my family. Suddenly on the phone call, they said, well, that's going to be an issue. And so I asked them why. And they said, well, now we're going to have to do a language test on you. So that was, you know, that was one moment in which I immediately understood what being Latina meant and what being an immigrant meant, you know, for many people, even in this space where I thought that people understood that we came from different places.
Did life as a Latino help you to adjust in school? Hurt you? Tell us on Twitter at LatinoUSA and use the hashtag LatinoSchoolStories. So the LatinoUSA team spent some time thinking about how we could school you about some of the things we've learned after doing this show for 20 years. And for some of us at LatinoUSA, including yours truly, covering immigration has spanned our entire careers. So we thought we'd share some of the lessons we've learned about immigration policy in our country over this time. And we start with lesson number one. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Here's Barack Obama as a senator in 2007.
I think it's easy to say, in theory, we're going to deport 11 million people. I think it's much harder to expect police officers to grab fathers from their children and unilaterally send them across the border. I don't think it's realistic in terms of the resources that we have or that that's the kind of face of America that we want to see.
But that's exactly the face of America that Mr. Obama has put forward. Over 1.5 million people, more than ever before, have been deported since the start of this president's first term. And one of the largest workplace deportation raids ever just occurred last month at a chain of car washes in Arizona.
14 people face criminal charges. 30 were taken into custody over the weekend for immigration processing because they were ordered to leave the country after prior convictions. Another 179 people with no criminal histories released.
Okay, so change is hard to come by in Washington because these policies are, well, they're old policies. In fact, the last major game changer in terms of immigration was back in 1965.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power.
LBJ couldn't have been more wrong. The Immigration and Nationality Act began an era where family ties became as important as job skills in the immigration equation. And our reporting over the last 20 years has borne this out. We interviewed Neyel Cuevas, an immigrant from Mexico, in 2007. That was the last time immigration reform was actually on the table.
Staying close to the family is the most important thing, the foundation of everything. That's why we come, to work for the family so they lack nothing and everything is stable. For me, it's all about the family. Nothing else really matters.
Lesson two. The language we use has evolved. Sort of. 20 years ago, we placed a call to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS. They preceded ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency.
To find out how to report illegal aliens or employers of illegal aliens, dial 6 now.
That label, alien, hasn't always had the warmest reception. In fact, on our show, There have been a few times when we've explored the absolute weirdness of that term and other terms used to address immigrants.
Is Sergio a wetback?
No, Sergio is not a wetback. Sergio is an illegal. Guillermo is a wetback.
Good. Do you remember the little song we learned yesterday?
Yes, I remember.
Let's sing it.
Okay. One little, two little, three little aliens, four little, five little, six little aliens, seven little, eight little, nine little.
That was 1993. But since then, there have been periodic protests around the anger that terms like aliens and illegal create. In 1994, in 1996, in 2006. Now, we, and here I mean we as in the news media in particular, have gone from the notion of illegal aliens to illegal immigrants to undocumented in official AP style. But by the way, the newest label for immigrants, according to the Senate reform bill, is RPIs, Registered Provisional Immigrants. Anyways, as demographics change and the Latino population increases, the language continues to evolve. And we know that, and we're on top of that, gente. You can be sure of that. De eso pueden estar seguros. So we move on to lesson number three. It is less certain that attitudes will evolve along with language.
There are people in this country illegally who are planning to do great harm to us. It shouldn't be surprising to anybody. This is the problem.
Tom Tancredo of Colorado served 5 terms, 10 years as a congressman. He's always been one of the more radical public officials when it comes to deporting undocumented immigrants, but he's not alone. In Georgia, D.A. King is a self-described activist against people he calls illegal aliens. He shared with us why he protests organizations like MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, back in 2006.
I protest MALDEF because they are a race-based organization that encourages bilingualism in my country, open borders, and they insist upon giving the rights of real, legal immigrants and citizens to illegal aliens.
So while nativism will probably never disappear, it's a phenomenon as old as manifest destiny, we can always hope to count on people's compassion. Which leads us to lesson four, which is that some things do change. More immigrants are living and working in suburbs and rural areas than ever before. Because as white flight starts to reverse, with cities around the country experiencing gentrification or development, whatever you want to call it, Latinos have been moving out. Latino USA was covering that trend years ago. We profiled this Iowa church in 1997.
From my point of view, the people that we're dealing with are the people who are at most risk in the world today.
Pastor Gil Dawes leads the Spanish language services in a church that has gone a step beyond meeting the spiritual needs of the Hispanic immigrant population in Iowa, which by and large is employed by meatpacking companies. Trinity Church is providing a place to live for undocumented immigrants who fear being deported.
And if we want to understand how our world is impacting other people, they're the folks we've got to hear from. And if they can trust us enough to tell us what they really think, then we will understand our responsibility.
And so, as this church's involvement illustrates, there is a moral dimension to immigration, legal or illegal, which Americans cannot ignore. Which brings us back to what then-Senator Obama had to say in 2007.
I think it's much harder to expect police officers to grab fathers from their children and unilaterally send them across the border. I don't think it's realistic in terms of the resources that we have or that that's the kind of face of America that we want to see.
So what kind of America do we want to live in? Who does it include? The answer is always mixed. Come, stay, go away, help us, we want you, we love you, we hate you. But ultimately, the answers aren't just up to Congress, where immigration reform hangs in the balance right now. The answers are up to each of us. So, lesson five, don't just stand by and watch history unfold. Be a part of it. A student isn't always easy, especially when you're all of a sudden in a world you don't understand. Here's another school story.
My name is Sara Inez Calderon, and I'm a journalist in Los Angeles. When I first got to college, it was the first time that I got a cell phone, and for some reason I decided that I needed to start calling all of my relatives on the weekend with my free nights and weekends. So what ended up happening was, because I had this access to this cell phone, I ended up getting really, really close to my grandfather. And my, you know, parallel education at Stanford was my grandfather. So it was good, because I don't know about other people who I went to school with, but when I went to Stanford, I found it very disconcerting, because there was all this money and all of this privilege and all of this power. And I was just some girl from San Antonio, and I didn't understand how to relate to all of those people. And my grandfather kind of really kept me grounded. If I was going through like a really hard time, he would say, you know, se sufre para merecer, mija, which means what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So for me, that meant a lot, and it kind of helped me focus a little bit better.
I remember being the only Latina in my public elementary classroom in Chicago in the 1960s. I had never heard of the word minority back then, but I think I knew that I was one. But Latino kids now, in many places, are not the minority, but instead the majority. Our country has changed, and the story of educating Latinos has changed too. The most trusted voice covering that story for 24 years is a Latino USA friend and colleague. He's Claudio Sanchez. He joins us now from the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. to talk about his beat. Bienvenido. Welcome back to Latino USA, Claudio.
Great to be with you. Saludos, Maria.
Saludos, Claudio. Claudio, you have been covering education since 1989 for NPR. So what were we talking about as a nation about Latinos in education back in 1989?
Not much, Maria. In 1989, keep in mind that the first President Bush convened an education summit with governors, but there was little or no discussion about the most disadvantaged, segregated school children trapped in failing schools. It would be up to the states to deal with the problem, and we all know what happens when you leave it up to the states. Often, this just falls off the radar.
So you're saying that at that moment, Latinos basically weren't even on the radar?
They were, but they were not a priority. This was a time when the discussion about the overall crisis in American public education was really paramount, but there was really no strategy, no real serious thinking about how to address this population and its educational needs.
So when did that change, Claudio, and what did you see happen?
It changed incrementally, but by 2001, there was something that experts called demographic imperative, and that was clearly because of the growth of the Latino population. So the rhetoric changed. And I think that what happened was a realization that if we did not do well by this population, we would really, really fall behind.
So what about now, 2013? What's happening now that is new and different in terms of talking about educating the Latino population in the United States?
Well, forgive the cliche, but it's the best of times and it's the worst of times. The Pew Research Center found some remarkable gains, what many consider to be a milestone. In 2000, fewer than half of Latinos enrolled in college right after high school. In 2012, Maria, 12 years later, about 70% enrolled in college. And that is a sea change. There's many, many reasons for it, but namely, it is that the numbers are driving a sense of urgency.
And what about the challenges?
For every good thing that has happened with this population, namely college attendance, there are still huge problems. And one of those includes the dropout rate. Even though Latino dropout rates have been cut in half since 2000, among 16 to 24-year-old Latinos today, still about 17% or so did not finish high school. I don't think there is a single silver bullet for keeping them in school. But the biggest change we've seen in school policy has been that the range of programs, alternatives for these kids to do better, have grown and multiplied, especially in inner city school systems.
So, Claudio, what have you, as an observer, and somebody who's been covering this for so many years, learned about educating Latinos in the United States?
I think we have to look at what's going on with preschool education, with the early grades of these kids. And let me give you an example of a UC Berkeley study that showed that even though Latinos are the least likely to attend preschool, there is a lot of evidence, Maria, that these kids' emotional maturity and social agility have been the missing link when devising strategies to help them catch up academically. Because when teachers take into account these kids' eagerness to learn and get along, it's much easier for them to adapt to the classroom quickly and learn English quickly. And I think that the challenge ahead is given this new sense of urgency about the growth of the Latino population, is that we're taking this research a little bit more seriously, and it's beginning to trickle down to the teacher, to the classroom.
I love the fact that people can now recognize the social and emotional skills that these young Latino students bring into pre-K and kindergarten. It's kind of uplifting and beautiful, no?
It sure is. And again, it's not a hunch. It is fact. It is research that is pretty conclusive. Let's not forget that the political motivation for doing well by these kids has really been pushed by the Dreamers. Their activity, their mobilization has done an enormous amount to just bring this issue to the table. And it's not just for their benefit. It's really been for the benefit of Latino youth in this country.
Claudia Sanchez, thanks for doing such great work for the past 24 years as NPR's education correspondent.
Good to be with you, Maria.
Gracias, Claudio. And now, a school story from a politician.
My name is Luis Vicente Gutierrez Olmedo. I'm an 11-term member of Congress from the 4th Congressional District of the City of Chicago. Even though first grade should be like, you know, happy-go-lucky time, and it was for the most part, but I remember that they had 1A, 1B, and 1C. And Luis Gutierrez and all the other little Latino kids were in 1C. But I do remember the sense of going to school, and not because of anything I did that would make me look or feel awkward or out of touch, but the way the school system received me as being different. And I remember the little Puerto Rican kids being games of checkers and Parcheesi because the teachers had such great difficulty communicating with them that instead of trying to educate them, there was this pacification or alienation of the young kids from the basic public school system.
Coming up on the new Latino USA.
Now she's like voguing through the girls' locker room in this black double D lace bra like it's a trophy. And believe it or not, I wasn't jealous.
School stories get personal. So quédense con nosotros. You'll want to hear this. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and we're bringing you stories about school time. And what else did you study, if not body language?
Hi, my name is Michelle Carlo. I'm a redheaded New Yorican, a storyteller, and the author of Fish Out of Agua, My Life on Neither Side of the Subway Tracks. It was the first day of 10th grade. And in gym class, who do I see but my girlfriend, who the last time I had seen her in June, she was like totally flat-chested. But now she's like voguing through the girls' locker room in this black double D lace bra like it's a trophy. And believe it or not, I wasn't jealous. Because when you're Latin like I am, your body part of choice is the butt. And you could say, well, yeah, everybody has a butt. What's the big deal? Because, see, it's not the perfect Latin butt. You know, two teardrop-shaped globes of firm, pliant, undimpled muscle. And the big deal was I didn't have one. I mean, I was like totally fat and flat. And this was such a source of concern with the women in my family. They called the Chicho Council to talk about my lack of development. And my mother put me on this really strict diet and exercise routine, like no rice, no beans, no french fries, no tostones, and in other words, nothing good. And of course, that didn't work. So one day I'm at my friend's house and I see through, you know, the door that she's stuffing her bra with like tissues. And I wasn't upset. I just thought like, oh, well, why don't I stuff my butt? So I did. So no one in my family noticed, but that Monday at gym class, I'm trying to get undressed by the lockers, and I guess it was sticking out of my underwear. So my girlfriend comes over, and she pulls it out. So I'm busted for stuffing. So I start a fight with her, and I push her, and she falls over, and her bra pops open, and all these enough pink Kleenex for every Ortiz funeral parlor in the Bronx and half of Brooklyn pop out. So maybe we didn't talk for a long time, but I got my revenge. I grew over 2 inches that year, and that extra 10 pounds around my middle migrated just the right distance and produced, to this day, some of the finest nalgas in my entire familia.
So how did you grow up and fill out? Well, share your story with us. We're Latino USA on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. One area where Latinos are underrepresented is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics studies. But this summer, I met four friends who are trying to change that. Sonia, Alma, Xochitl, and Marcela. They're all Latinas, all graduating from DePaul University in Chicago with degrees in environmental science. I loved that they had this Latina STEM sisterhood, so I invited them to talk with us about what they've been up to since they graduated in June in a segment we call the STEM Sisters. When I met you guys, it was the Latino graduation ceremony at DePaul University in June of 2013, and I had never been to a Latino graduation, which is basically a parallel graduation social event, cultural event for the families of Latino graduates, many of which are the first-time graduates from college in their families. And there you were, the four of you, all graduating with environmental science degrees. All Latinas, but you're so different from each other. I mean, you're all the same in some ways, but then you're incredibly different. I was fascinated. And as the four of you have developed this friendship, have you found that being Latina and your interest in the environment, is there this notion that there could be something in your backgrounds, as different as they may be, that ended up kind of pointing you towards this interest in the environment? Xochitl.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think so, because see, from my point of view, my parents lived very poorly. They lived in Mexico. They grew up on farms. They helped their parents with farming. If I talk to my grandparents, they'll sit down and talk to me like 30 minutes about how to properly water plants. So I think we definitely are connected. My parents, when they first came to the United States, they were working on farms, helping with harvest. That's kind of the jobs that for some reason, Mexicans are really drawn to, not by choice, but at the same time, it's because we're I don't know if good at it or if because we're used to it, or I'm not really sure what it is, but there definitely is a connection, I believe, of Latinos and Latinas really recognizing that you are part of this earth, that we're not, you know, these high and mighty superhumans, that because we've created technology and buildings that, you know, we're not humble enough to work, really get down and get our hands dirty.
Yeah, this is Sonia. Personally, I just found out this year, my dad actually was, he was in the agriculture industry when he was in Mexico. And he didn't tell me this when I was growing up. For some reason, we never talked about what he did when he was in Mexico, when he lived with his, because he had an education and he had his career before coming over here. But I don't know, I guess I just never asked about it. It wasn't until we took a class and we had to do a soil lab. We had to do soil testing and water testing. And it wasn't until I actually had to go out there and get the soil and water. My dad's like, oh, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm going to go and get some soil and water. He's like, oh, well, that's cool. I can help you. I know how to do that. And I thought he was playing around with me because he just jokes around a lot. I'm like, yeah, sure, Dad. He's like, no, for real. That's what I did. And on our way to collect the soil, he was telling me about how when he was in Mexico, that's what he would do. He would work for the government and he would do soil testing for agricultural lands. And I just thought that was so amazing to me that he knew what I was studying. Not a lot of people know. I tell someone, oh, I'm an environmental studies major, science major, and they're like, oh, you're a tree hugger. Like, they don't know what it actually is. And to have my father, someone that I'm really close to, know what I'm talking about, that was great. It encouraged me even more.
So how did you all meet at DePaul?
So I think it started with Alma and Sochi, correct?
Yes. So what happened was that I changed my major. I was a business major my first 2 years at DePaul. And then I started taking environmental studies and sciences courses. And then Alma, I believe, was already an environmental studies major. She was in that major, and I just kind of saw her, and then we started talking.
But I met you in the Environmental Consent Committee.
That's so true. The ECC.
And what is the ECC at DePaul University?
It's an organization. Well, it's not an organization. It's like a club. Basically, we do things for like the environment to teach the students and what kind of things they can do. We also took part of activisms and protests and such like that.
Were there a lot of other Latinos?
Actually, no. I was the only Latina in that group. I was surrounded by Caucasian people, and which, I mean, it was uncomfortable. But I got used to it because it's just, especially when you live in a white area, I mean, you're used to the people you're with.
Yeah, until I came along and then saw Alma, and we just, like, connected, and then after that, we had multiple classes. And then I saw Marcella in a few of my classes. She was kind of shy, so I'd always say hi to her. She, you know, was kind of quiet. And then I didn't see Sonia until my senior year.
So when you were in your environmental science classes, were you looking around and saying, oh, wow, there aren't any Latinos here, or there aren't any African-Americans here, or there aren't any women here?
Yes, yeah. It's very noticeable. Yeah. I don't know. I think there's like a handful of, you know, except us, who are Latinos in our field, in our major. We pretty much had, it's a really small department, so we pretty much had classes with everyone. Yeah. And we knew everyone at the department, basically, or at least have seen them. And I didn't see that many Latinos in our department. I think just them, the girls, and probably like three other people.
It's definitely, like we mentioned earlier, it's definitely noticeable. And honestly, to me, it makes me not frustrated, but in a way it kind of does, because this is a field that I believe is extremely important. You know, especially Latinos, we're raised in a way of appreciation towards, you know, your food. You're raised with appreciation towards your land. I wanted to put that word out there. Like, if anything, me taking the first step and being a Latina doing this just made me think, well, you know, if I loved it so much and I understood it so well, you know, other Latinos will do it.
So other Latinas might say, hey, let's go to the mall and go try on some gowns and some shoes and let's get some makeup. And you guys are saying, let's plan our next big hike and where we're going to go camping.
Yes. That's right. What we, or go out for breakfast. We all love to eat a lot.
Oh, so yeah.
That might be what we're going to do after this.
All right. So what's the favorite food of the STEM sisters? Where are you going to go eat?
Ooh. Where are we going to go eat?
I don't know. I'll
plan that.
That's a very good question. We always have a hard time deciding.
We're very indecisive.
I'm not.
It's different because Sochi is vegan and Marcella and myself, we're vegetarians. And but Sonia, she eats meat.
I'm a meat eater. But I accommodate to them. I always say wherever they want to go, and then I'll find something there. Because I think it's harder to go for me somewhere where they have meat and find something that doesn't have meat. So I accommodate to what they want. Because, I mean, I eat vegetables, too. I like meat. I eat meat, too. So they'll have them pick, and then from there, I'll pick something, too.
From here, anywhere that has guacamole and some salsa, I'll eat that. That's about all I need.
But what's interesting is that you don't judge each other. You're not saying, oh, my God, you know, I'm a vegan, but Sonia eats meat and híjole, no. Tiene que cambiar.
I mean, we don't judge each other.
Oh, yeah.
We joke around.
We always say
we
that.
Judge.
We always say that. We're like, this is a judge-free zone. Yeah, we always say that to each other. Like, if someone wants to say something, we're like, wait, we can't judge each other. Okay, fine. Just say what you need to say.
So how does it look in terms of your career? I mean, you graduated in June 2013 with degrees. So, Sonia, have you found work in something regarding your field of environmental science?
I actually did. I just got a job. I got called back on Monday. They offered me the position. I start next Friday. It's at the Whedon Park District that I'm going to be working at. It's sort of like an instructor for the programs that they offer, kind of like education, but to do with the environment and to pretty much reach out to children and attract them into this field. So I'm excited.
So does that mean you get to wear a cool little uniform?
Yes, I got to order my uniform. And yeah, eventually I'll be able to branch out from there. So I'm really excited. Like, I know where I want to go. I just have to get that qualification and that experience in order for me to get there.
So Marcela, what about you? Have you been able to find any work with your degree?
I'm still working on it right now, but I really want to get into environmental education, like with a nature center, or I really would like to do ecological restoration with like forest preserve. So right now I'm like working on it. I'm not exactly there. I'm still like finishing up like on little things on my resume and just getting everything ready. So, but I will be starting to apply very, very soon. So I'm really excited, and I hope I can find something that I'm going to really enjoy and obviously be outside.
Alma, what about you?
Well, I don't have a job yet, but I just 2 days ago, I sent applications to working for like parks, and I'm also applying into like some federal government job positions. I know it's very difficult, especially since I don't have the experience. So I'm trying to, right now, I'm applying to like American Corps where I can get the experience, the skills, so I can get into a better position working with the government.
And Xochitl?
Well, I currently just finished my internship at Japal. It was a community-based internship. But right now, as far as an actual commitment job or something that I'm really going to, you know, do long term or get that experience, I think I'm going to hold on for that for a little bit longer. Right now, I have plans of I'm going to move down to Tennessee and I'm going to farm. And we have a house down there. So I'm going to make a garden, take care of cows and chickens and kind of, you know, start from the nitty gritty and then, you know, really get my experience with my past internship. I was really interested in soil science, so I'm kind of gonna lean more towards the science of agriculture and even humans later on, and then kind of see where that leads me.
Okay, so I'm fascinated, but I do need to know how it is that you ended up having a house in Tennessee.
I'll tell you. Well, my partner, her dad has a house down there. He lives in Tennessee. And a few years ago, she was going to go move down there and actually start this project on her own. She was going to, you know, live in the farm, make the garden, you know, do the whole thing. But then we got together and, you know, we both have very similar interests. I actually, you know, studied it. She was just very interested in it and has volunteered in various places throughout the city during urban agriculture. And we just decided, like, let's actually do this. Now that I'm done with school, I want to continue on learning about agriculture, learning about, you know, soils, plants, and all this stuff. And, you know, it's happening so perfectly that her dad has a house there, and we're moving down there in 3 weeks. So I'm excited.
and we're all coming to visit.
Feel free. Right. We have a pool.
If you need help, we have your helpers here.
Oh, yeah. I will need lots of help, guys.
Sonia, thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you.
Marcela, muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasant experience.
Alma, thank you so much.
Thank you as well.
And gracias, Xochitl.
Gracias. Muchas gracias, María.
You'll hear more about our STEM sisters throughout the year, hitting the glass ceiling, mentoring, and being mentored. Why, we even created a hashtag called STEM Sisters. So if you have any questions about science as a career that you want the STEM Sisters to talk about, let us know via Twitter, Facebook, or on our website, latinousa.org. And don't forget that hashtag, STEM Sisters. We're going to leave you with the last of our school stories in a segment we call Sabiduría. This one is from our friend, Marta Moreno Vega. Dr. Vega is a legendary scholar of the African diaspora, the founder of the Caribbean Cultural Center in New York City, a community activist, practicing santera, and yes, if you'll indulge a term, she is a wise Latina. We'll be hearing from Dr. Vega and others at the end of every show to leave you with a bit of sabiduría, words of wisdom, which in this case take the form of a dicho, a saying. Pal gusto se hicieron los colores. Here's Dr. Vega.
When I got to high school, that was the first time I was out of my community. I grew up in East Harlem, went to elementary and junior high school in East Harlem. So almost everyone around me was into the same things. You know, we saw the world the same way. We, you know, played the same things, danced to the same rhythms and so on. And when I went to music and art and was in a primarily Eurocentric setting, as opposed to a very Puerto Rican setting, things were so very different, you know. And I would come home always complaining, like, you know, everybody uses grays and, you know, and instead of, like, bright colors. And the teacher hollered at me because I used yellows and greens, and then I had patterns and so on and so forth. And my mother would say, you know, por gusto se hicieron los colores. That's why, you know, people make colors, because different people like different things. So what you like, maybe somebody else doesn't like, but it doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means that it's different. And I think that that's something that we all have to face, right? That our perspective is not the only perspective. So por gusto se hicieron los colores.
And for this week, that's our show. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Roberto Aguilar is our intern. This week, we had additional engineering from Brendan Baker and Stephanie LeBeau, and additional reporting by Dan Weissman. I'm host and executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Latino USA was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. We do hope you enjoyed our hour-long show, so do let us know and tune in again next week.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure safety and prevent oil spills in the U.S. Arctic Ocean at pewtrusts.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.